found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for listening. We're here weekday mornings at 9 o'clock at latalkradio.com, where you can listen live, stream, and then later during the day, you can download the podcast also here and at mariasanchezshow.com and themariasanchezshow.com. Thank you for allowing us to join you. It is Wednesday, June 12th. I'm always happy on Wednesday, well, not because it's hump day, but because my sons come for dinner. And we've been doing this for years now. They haven't been living with me for about 2.5 years or so. And I just wanted to set up a regular tradition. So we've been having dinner once a week for years now. And they just decided about 2 months ago that they were going to participate in the process. So every other week they cook, and tonight is that week. So I just get to sit there and sit in the kitchen, watch them cook, have conversation. And then they ask me to do the dishes, which I'm more than happy to do. And sometimes they even do the dishes. So it's like, okay, cool. We have on our program our circumcision correspondent. We have probably about a dozen and a half, maybe two dozen correspondents that visit with us regularly, depending upon their field of expertise and what's in the news. Well, circumcision has been in the news. There's been about three different stories recently. So we're going to speak with Stephen Savoda, who is a Harvard Law graduate and practices in Northern California. He's married to a physician. They have two sons, and he's what you would call an intactivist. And he promotes intactivision, which means genital integrity and no genital mutilation or cutting. These are terms that he uses when we have our discussion. So he's coming up. He's our first guest. And then later on in the program, there's a huge casting call for Felony Magazine, so we're going to help promote that. And we've got some great stories in the news, but I have to say, talk about rare air last night at the NBA Finals with the Miami Heat and the San Antonio Spurs Game 3. It was tied 1-1 going into last night's competition, and it was fairly even. I have AT&T UVerse, and on Friday night, all of a sudden, a red X appeared on my screen, and I normally have my television on only so that I can listen to music. I'm not a TV viewer at all. If I have time to watch TV, I'd rather read. And but I'd like to have the music on. So I finally called on Saturday, and all of this happens with, you know, technical. There's like not a person. So you call this number. They say, what do you want? You speak to this machine. They say, 1 second. They go offline. They test the equipment. They say, yes, you need to have a technician. So they actually, to their credit, wanted to send somebody on Sunday, and I had so much going on Sunday. I was like, no, I'm not waiting around a four-hour window for somebody to come on Sunday. I'm not that needy for television. So they set it. We set it up for Monday at noon. And I went on my morning hike after the broadcast, and wouldn't you know, the technician showed up not only on time but early. So by the time I got back to my house, he had already left. So reset it up for yesterday from 4 to 8, and the guy came in, I don't know, about 5:15 or something, 5:30. He left in time for me to be able to watch the NBA Finals. There I am. I'm thinking to myself, how many women sit by themselves watching sporting events? I was having some hummus, a glass of wine, and had steamed an artichoke. And San Antonio, they were hot, hot, hot. And obviously talk about home court advantage, too, because the crowd stayed till the bitter end. It was just amazing athleticism. I love to watch folks do what they do when they're at the top of their game. It's just so much fun. Okay, so in the news today is using voice commands to send text messages and emails while driving is more distracting and dangerous than simply talking on the phone. And this is according to AAA, a study that they had. They're saying talking on a hands-free phone isn't significantly safer for drivers than talking on a handheld phone, and using the hands-free devices that translate speech into text is actually the most distracting of all because it requires greater concentration. And the greater the concentration, the more likely the driver is developed something that they call tunnel vision or inattention blindness. And that's when you stop looking on the road back and forth. You stop paying attention to your side view and your rear view mirrors. Instead, we look straight ahead and actually fail to see what's in front of us. So according to AAA, there are about 9 million cars and trucks on the road with what they term an infotainment system. That's going to jump to about 62 million vehicles by 2018. And AAA, here's their quote, "We believe there is a public safety crisis looming." Now, a recent National Highway Traffic Safety Administration study says that they found that the handheld phone use was less safe than hands-free. But the University of Utah did the study for AAA, and they went into the whole thing of how they did it, and they measured the brain waves and the eye movement and the performance. They had cameras in there to measure their eye and head movements, and they also used something that was called, exceptionally high fidelity system that makes no errors when you're speaking to it. And those systems in the cars aren't as good. So they're saying, and this is from the University of Utah, that means that the study probably underestimates the concentration required of drivers. So concentrating on creating a text message and trying to get it right takes more mental time and effort. And the more complex the task, the longer the interactions, the more likely to have impairments while you're driving. So I don't know what that means if you're accustomed to doing that, what you should do, but you should know that's just out today. Here's something I thought was fabulous and I believe is self-evident. If you're a social media user, especially Facebook or Twitter, they're saying that those sites are a big draw for narcissists. And they talk about what kind of narcissist is attracted to which methodology. And it makes sense because what I see a lot on Facebook is that people are promoting what they're doing. And I have to say, I am no different. The only reason that I joined Facebook in the first place was because I was with the American Red Cross. And I was using it to exploit the American Red Cross's messaging. And by exploit, I don't mean take advantage of, but what I mean is to get the word out. So I used it for development and for communications, which was my position at the time. And I never intended it to be a network of my friends, because I always said at that time, my friends, I have their emails and I have their phone numbers. Why do I need to go on Facebook? I get it now, especially if you keep it down to just the people, a coterie of people that you really care about. Me, I've got 5,200 friends, so it's like, it's not really personal. But so they studied, they say that the study details how young adults of college age and their adult counterparts use social media in differing ways to bolster their egos and control perceptions of others. So vain college-age students favor Twitter. And the quote is, young people overvaluate the importance of their opinions, that's the researcher. Through Twitter, they're trying to broaden their social circles and broadcast their views from a wide range of topics and issues. Adults, however, who exhibit narcissism tend to prefer Facebook because it serves as a mirror. It's about curating your own image. They say middle-aged adults usually have already formed who we are, and then they're using social media to gain approval from those who we're already friendly with in our social circles. So among young college students, they found that those who scored higher in certain types of narcissism posted more often on Twitter, and that narcissists posted more frequent status updates on Facebook. Duh, doesn't that make sense? I'm one of those folks that I try not to post too often because I don't like being banged on by somebody every day, especially multiple times a day. I think you become a part of the wallpaper of their life instead of making it make a difference. So I try and met out my postings, but when somebody keeps going on and on and on, it's like, wow, really? Okay, I got it the first time. So I don't know why this is totally and completely captivating me, but the cicadas have blossomed. And we've been mentioning it because they were coming, and now they're here. What is a cicada? There are different kinds, but the kind that is fascinating me, yours truly more than the others, are the ones that are coming up to the surface of the planet Earth after 17 years of gestation. So their life cycle is this. A young cicada, or nymph, as they're also called, lives about 6 to 18 inches underground, so a half foot to a foot and a half. They get their sustenance by sap from the tree roots, and they grow to about 1.5 inches underground for 17 years. As they get to about 17 years of age, they dig a tunnel to the surface with their front legs, and that creates a small mound of mud, a cicada hut, and that's how they get up onto the surface. But they have to wait until the ground temperatures reach 64 degrees. Then they get out of that tunnel and they climb onto the nearby trees where they shed their skins or molt. Adult cicadas live for only 4 to 6 weeks. This is after 17 years of gestation. Their whole goal is to mate and produce eggs. They can fly, but they normally don't. They stay right near where they emerged. The males are the ones that make the sound. And if you go online, you can see and hear what I'm talking about. In fact, I watched a couple of the documentaries about it. And they, when they were showing the male and the female mating, they blurred it out. Like cicada sex is not something that you want to be looking at or whatever. I don't know what that was about. It's the internet, for goodness sakes. So the male does the buzz. That's supposed to attract the female. The females respond with a flick of their wings. They mate. The female cicadas slice open tree twigs and lay as many as a dozen eggs in a single twig. The eggs remain on the twig for 6 to 10 weeks before they hatch into the nymphs, which is about the size of a grain of rice. The nymphs then fall to the ground, dig into the soil, and feed for the next 17 years. I just think that is remarkable. We spoke with a man who's studying them. This is his third cycle of studying them. And he's like, I'm so busy, I can't talk to you. And I was like, all right, whatever. So we're speaking with Stephen Savoda now, our circumcision correspondent, about the stories that are in the news. And Stephen, as always, is a lively conversationalist.
Stephen Savoda here.
There you go. Good morning. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us live and on the air, Stephen. Appreciate your time.
Thank
as
you very
always.
Much.
I call you the intactivist, as well as my circumcision correspondent. So where do you want to start, Stephen?
Not a word that necessarily everyone knows, but it's a word that was coined for people who are organizing to educate the world about the harms of circumcision.
And your zealous goal is that you are intactivisms.
Right. That's
yes.
Another, that's sort of the corresponding word for the movement, yeah.
And you have a wonderful way of framing it, preserving genital integrity as we were meant to be, as the Creator created us, not as man has decided we should be.
Right. Well, it gets old to always be sort of arguing against something. I mean, the way I look at it, we're not really against anything. We're for sanity, and we're for not doing needless medical procedures. And so it makes a lot of sense to focus on that.
So, Stephen, let's talk about Prepex, since that's the most recent story in the news. And it is a non-surgical circumcision device. Do you want to speak about the procedure a little bit, and then we'll talk about why it made the news?
Speak about circumcision in general or about this Prepex device?
About the Prepex device.
Right. Well, let me back up a little bit because, Maria, as you know, this issue is the issue of circumcision. It has so many wrinkles to it and so many aspects to it. And if you look back at the historical development, starting when it was first medicalized about 150 years ago, all along the way, there's just been one suggested reason for doing this procedure after another. And, you know, one reason, like what used to be called venereal disease or preventing cancer in the partner of the person, which it turned out the belief in that was actually just associated with the fact that the Orthodox Jewish families that this original study was done on have much healthier lifestyles, basically. And that was the reason for partners of Orthodox Jewish women, basically partners of Orthodox Jewish men who obviously are circumcised, getting cervical cancer less. It was due to that. It wasn't due to any magical help that came from the circumcision procedure. But that myth was purveyed, and it seems that as every myth is disproven, a new one gets put in its place, usually reflecting the current fear of the times. And so the latest one we've been confronting is the myth that circumcision supposedly helps stop HIV. Now, there's a study that just came out, or at least I just became aware of it today, that actually points in the opposite direction, that having a foreskin is actually associated with protection against HIV. But you don't even have to get into looking at the medical evidence. I hesitate to even use that word, but the medical evidence on both sides to see that. I mean, the human body exists perfect as it is. Granted, there's individual cases where obviously surgery has to be done to help people, but the default is you leave it alone unless proven otherwise. Mm-hmm. And we've come into Africa in this very imperialistic, very sort of typically American way, and Johns Hopkins has been leading the charge along with the World Health Organization, which, you know, obviously isn't a specifically American organization, but we have great influence there, and some other influential, primarily American institutions. And we've come in and we've said, look, we're the shining knights. We've got this great solution to cure you oversexed Africans of all the problems you've caused by your sexuality. The arrogance of it is just breathtaking. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to circumcise. So we're going to perform this procedure that for many African groups is really completely unknown and is contrary to their culture. We're going to come in and we're going to do this thing and it's going to be wonderful. It's going to make your lives great. And as was the case, if you go back in history with many of the other times when we Westerners try to tell developed world people such things, it turned out it isn't so great. And so the latest wrinkle on this, and I told you, Maria, that I got the latest issue of J, the Jewish Newsweekly, from the local Jewish Community Center and pulled it out. It's an interesting magazine. I like to read it. And here I am looking at page 15, half an hour before this show. The exact article you sent me, WHO approves Israeli developed circumcision device. So this prepex, this device that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has put its stamp of approval on, is supposed to be a non-surgical circumcision device. Now, let's think about that a little bit. It sounds great, right? Non-surgical, I mean, we all like to avoid surgery, like we all like to avoid litigation, mm-hmm. pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But you're taking off tissue, you're taking off functional tissue. So what does non-surgical even mean? Okay, I understand the way the thing is supposed to work is that it uses some rubber bands and similar things to cut off the blood flow so that the foreskin dies from lack of oxygen, according to this press release, and either falls off on its own or is easily cut off, which obviously would constitute cutting. So, you know, it's in a way, it's a microcosm of the whole issue, Maria. I mean, it's squeaky clean, it's modern, it's new, it sounds great, non-surgical circumcision device. Even the word circumcision hides from us the fact that we're removing functional tissue that has erogenous, protective, and immunological functions for an infant that doesn't have the right to say whether it's okay with that infant or not, at least as applied in the U.S., that's the case. And in Africa, it's a different sort of imperialism where maybe it's an adult who's consenting to it and they're being told by you know, these powers that supposedly know more about it than they do, that, oh, this is great, this will protect you, this will stop AIDS. And everybody shares the World Health Organization's concern with HIV and with AIDS. Obviously, we all recognize that it's one of the worst public health issues that has ever happened. You can say that, it's so obvious. And yet, you know, it is coming under control. It's coming under control of its own volition, so to speak, just as the demographics are playing out. And there are other means of combating it that are starting to come to light.
You're speaking about HIV and AIDS.
HIV, yeah, that are being researched. So it's really curious that we've got this drive to find other ways to circumcise when there's other factors that are coming in that are already bringing HIV and AIDS under control.
Well, but here's what I find troubling about this story, Stephen. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but who is Dr. Goosby, who is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, he was quoted in the New York Times article that talked about the prepix. He said that this will truly help save lives, and he was considering the immediate employment of funds from his emergency plan for AIDS relief to pay for the use of this procedure, of which apparently the United States has paid for more than 2 million circumcisions to date in Africa, all under the guise of helping spare them from HIV.
Well, it's pretty interesting because 2 million is the number of circumcisions approximately that happened in the U.S. in 2 years. To think that that number is being exported, so to speak, it's one of our most embarrassing and wasteful and harmful exports, I think, that we've ever done. But, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's an emergency. They're talking about it as an emergency. We've got to cut off the functional tissue of these people. It's an emergency. It has to be done right away. And you notice, though, that everyone who talks about this says, but be sure to keep using a condom. Don't think that this is a cure-all, that this is going to make you 100% safe. Well, if it isn't, then why is the procedure being done in the first place?
Well, and I would imagine that they're doing this to adult males, not to the infants.
Because the infants aren't having intercourse. It's being used logically, or I should say illogically, to somehow buttress the infant circumcision in the U.S. But, you know, yes, absolutely. It's not being intended as primarily an infant procedure in Africa.
Well, because obviously the infants aren't having intercourse, so they're not the ones that are being exposed to the HIV.
But it may seem logical to you, but there's so many times that illogic succeeds in this area that I wouldn't rest safely in any thought like that. But you're right, of course.
So the question I have is, with your American Rights for the Child, do you weigh in on this with the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, with the World Health Organization, with these folks that are huge proponents of doing this?
We do what we can. I mean, Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, as you know, was at the United Nations in 2001, and we worked with the World Health Organization. We were there, and we've been in dialogue since then, and we do what we can. I mean, they don't make it easy. They're pretty impervious to our message, and they find ways to avoid it, but we keep knocking at the door, as do the other organizations that are working on these issues, because we have to. We have to keep conveying the message, and you know, we are making progress, Marie. I mean, I talked about this on our last show, but you look at where the movement is now versus where it was 5 to 10 years ago, and even 5 years ago, and it's, which was the last time you and I had talked prior to our last show, mm-hmm. and it's really such an evolution for the positive. I mean, people are really starting to get this, and people go on the internet, which is getting more and more powerful every day, and they look around, and it just confirms their thought, this doesn't make sense. Why would I do this? And you're seeing it, you know, an article just came out a few days ago, a scholarly article that cited the article by Bob Van Hallen about the American Academy of Pediatrics, and that article was written by an undergraduate who's an Orthodox Jew, and he researched this, and he decided that it didn't make sense. So
Wow. We're
seeing folks in all parts starting to really look at this practice and question it for themselves.
And if you may, for some first-time listeners that haven't heard our conversations before, there's some general terms about circumcision as it is performed in the rest of the world versus as the United States, and then now how those numbers have changed, and then I guess even California is further ahead of the United States and the changing in their behaviors in that regard.
That's right. Well, I'm in Berkeley too, which is sort of a little island, and for better and for worse. But no, it's true. I mean, the rates in the U.S. of circumcision are really different. I mean, they tend to be higher in the middle of the country. They tend to be lower on the coasts. On the West Coast, nobody has exact numbers, but it seems something on the order of 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4 boys are being left intact these days, or are not being circumcised. And on the East Coast, there's been a lot of progress, too. I mean, there's been progress throughout the country, and we believe, and I just had a conference with some of the other top researchers on this, we're pretty confident the numbers are being doctored, and we've seen this before, where definitions can be stretched and data can be tweaked in a way that isn't blatant, but that lends itself to a suggestion that things are more status quo. We don't believe they're status quo. We have hard evidence that rates are dropping, and in fact, there was a study that came out in 2010 that strongly supported that. It came out from the Centers for Disease Control. And there's been further evidence accumulating. And just talk to your friends. See the word that's going on in the blogosphere. I mean, this is not a default thing that people do anymore without thinking about it.
Well, and I would imagine the boomers, since they've been responsible for pretty much everything, as they say, it's a football going through the garden hose, that maybe the awareness started towards the trail end, and hopefully it's going back down to the other generations as well. I'd be curious about the 20 and 30-somethings, what their feelings are about this.
Well, it's really interesting, you know, to watch it, because there's been a lot of people in that age bracket who have come into the movement. And a lot of times they'll come in and they won't even know there's a movement. They'll just come in and start a blog or start organizing locally. And at some point, maybe they become aware somehow that there are other people out there doing that also. But there's so much energy, Maria, right now. And, you know, when I started on this issue in 1995, or I guess it was 1994, you know, I pretty much knew within a fairly quick period of time all the people who were really doing much in the work, and now it's impossible, and that's great. You know, there's people doing great stuff that I will never meet and that I will never know, and that's fantastic. I couldn't be happier. I mean, our organization has always wished for its own obsolescence, and hopefully we'll be getting there sooner rather than later.
And what was the point that you decided that you had more than an opinion and that you wanted to be more vocal and active about it?
Well, it happened fairly quickly. I mean, like I say, at the time I started, there were a lot fewer people working on this, and we still are the only legally focused organization that I'm aware of, and I've really been focusing myself on. I mean, we now have several active collaborators with us that are doing tremendous work, like Peter Abbott, for example, our legal advisor, but I've been focusing really on the human rights issues and on the so-called consent issue, and I've written repeatedly about those topics, and also on the ethics, and so I've really sort of taken those on. But it first started, I guess it was just one of those things where I just had a disconnect on it. I just didn't understand how this made sense, and you know, here I am 19 years later still feeling like it doesn't make sense and working on it for that reason. I guess it seemed a little odd to me at first, and wasn't really necessarily my first choice issue, but as I looked into it, I realized that it really, really was important and work needed to be done on it.
And it was well before you became a father, because I can imagine, like my own brother, as I've shared with you, when he became a father of sons, that's when it became intimate to him about to cut or not, and subsequently he decided not to, but you hadn't been a dad yet, so it's just something.
Well, that's interesting, too. I mean, I started in 94, ARC got founded in early 97, Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, 1997, and our first child was born in 2002. And yes, you know, it's interesting because I never came at it from a real personal place. I mean, a lot of times people assume that, oh, that man who's involved with this issue must be really upset about his own circumcision. Well, I never came at it that way. I came at it more as it was a wrong thing to be doing. It should be stopped. It was a net loss for us as a society. We're wasting money. It's harmful, and I want to make the world a better place. And that's where I was coming from on it. So, you know, my children were born, and, you know, my son was born, and it's just now, as he's 11 years old now, that I'm starting a little bit, very sort of delicately with euphemisms, to sort of explain to him what Dad's nonprofit is about, because he's interested. And but it was never really about my kids or about anything personal. It was more about helping the world and sort of helping children in general. And, you know, and I think a lot of people in this movement come from the same place.
Well, you and I became acquainted when I was with NPR, and there was a story about the clitoral circumcisions that were going on in Africa. So that's when we first spoke. And when you compared that to circumcision, I was actually indignant. And I was like, no, there's no comparison. So you have educated me along the way, because I was like, oh, my goodness, how can you compare, you know, especially with blunt knives and all the blood that goes on with those kinds of procedures. But I have come to understand that mutilation is mutilation regardless of the gender.
Well, you're refreshing my memory. Yeah, and what you just said has been said in pretty much the exact words by some leading activists against female genital cutting, and even the very division in our nomenclature between male and female is interesting. But, you know, I got to say, like, I myself, I live in the same world with the same gender ideas that everyone else does, at least in the U.S., and, you know, I know that histologically, the less severe forms of male circumcision are histologically equivalent to female genital cutting, and yet, emotionally, female genital cutting sounds worse to me, too. But so what? I mean, we're trying to protect all children. I mean, ARC works to protect males and females alike. And whatever our gut-level emotional responses are to things, I mean, a lot of people in this country, their gut-level responses, it's no big deal. Why are you wasting your time? But does that mean they're right? Or does that mean that, like me, as I did in 1994, when you have that reaction, you might want to look into it a little further and see if your reaction is really justified. I mean, our first responses to things aren't always correct.
Mm-hmm. And let's speak, because this didn't really make mainstream news, but about the case that happened last month with a jury awarding a family of a partial amputation of a penis of a baby.
Right, so there was a award for $1.3 million, I think it was, and these, you know, that was good news. I mean, I always feel a little bit, what's the word? It doesn't feel like a ringing victory for the movement to me, and I always feel sorry for the particular child involved, and I can't really, what can I say? I mean, botches, so-called botches are, it's a pity that they happen, they're unnecessary, and in our view, every circumcision is a botch because it's needless surgery that takes away functional tissue that was not consented to by the person on whom it's done, who was unable to consent because of their young age.
I think that's where the difference is.
And I think what's going to happen is, and I think it's already happening, is the medical profession is going to start to notice these things, and insurers are going to start to notice these things, and that's going to be another force, along with the other forces, that's going to help diminish circumcision.
Well, because procedures get botched all the time, I'm sure regularly, hourly, daily, but if they're elective, or like my dad suffered one last month that he went in for a three-hour procedure, and 3.5 weeks later he's getting out of the hospital because the physician made a mistake and he almost bled to death.
Sure.
But when you talk, like you said, about a child who didn't have a choice in the matter and who people are doing it because they think that it's just a routine thing and something goes wrong, and this poor child now is apparently going to have scarring and have less nerve sensation, and it's like, wow, what a bummer. So the fact that there was a $1.3 million+ award given to the family means that people are getting more sympathetic with the understanding, or compassionate, if you will, about the unnecessariness of it.
That's right, and you've really put your finger on what really gets it for me. And there was a movie made in the 90s by Tim Hammond that was on PBS that actually got some awards about the circumcision issue. And in that movie, Norm Cohen, who's still working on the issue, made this comment, "We've been to the moon, and we've done all these amazing things, and we're still doing this thing." And that was in the 90s, and here we are in 2013, and we're still doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rates are down, but so here's a really cool thing, though. Here's one thing that from a lawsuit that is meaningful. There was a lawsuit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center over the genital mutilation of an intersex child, and that is so interesting. I mean, first of all, we've been talking for years about the interconnection between male circumcision and female circumcision and intersex cutting. So the intersex cutting is where a child is born that is not clearly either male or female. They have some sexual characteristics of both sexes, and in the old days, this made doctors and parents very uncomfortable, and there would be often some genital cutting done to make them have a so-called clear sex of one or the other. And nowadays, it's being questioned. It turns out that very rarely, almost never, is the intersex adult grateful that this so-called clarifying surgery was done when they were a child. So it's not exactly the same issue as these other forms of genital cutting, but it's certainly closely related. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is one of the most well-known public interest law centers in the country, and which doesn't typically focus on these issues, as you can tell from the first two words of its name, Southern Poverty, they took over this issue. And, you know, it's just interesting that we're starting to mainstream. I mean, granted, it's not male circumcision, but we're getting to the point where these issues are appealing to organizations that are really much more well-known to the public than, say, No Circle or Attorneys for the Rights of the Child are. Just another example of how, you know, academics are mentioning activism that aren't the academics aren't themselves intactivists. I mean, it's just another way in which the issue is becoming more recognized.
Well, I'm glad that you are still banging the drum and that you started it for the most altruistic reasons possible, that you didn't have an axe to grind, you didn't have an agenda, and you know that whatever we can do to help support the cause, we do. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time, because, again, this is not your day job. This is a nonprofit that you started. This is something that you do out of passion, and that makes it just even the better story.
Well, we don't get paid for this work, but we get paid in a lot of other ways. And knowing you, Maria, and talking to you is one of those ways, so thank you so much.
You're welcome, Stephen. Thank you again for your time. Thank you for making this world a better place. I talk about just the best of the best in terms of people's motives. Before we get to our next guest, since we've got we've been talking about penises, there's something in the news with the FDA. It's they're cracking down on sex supplements, and they sent a warning out this week about six products that were found to contain hidden drugs. So they've listed them, and heads up, in case these are over-the-counter items marked for sexual enhancement. Their brand names are Reload, Get It Up, Super Cheetah, Cave Diver, Nights to Remember, and X-Zen Platinum. All of the products were found to contain the drug that is sold under the brand name Viagra, and one was found to contain the drug that is sold under the brand name Cialis. Now, those drugs are used to treat erectile dysfunction, and sex supplements are not allowed to contain prescription drugs, duh, and the drugs are not included on the labels of those products. So the danger is, of course, is when you take these drugs without being told about their risks, both of those, Cialis and Viagra, can cause adverse reactions, including really low blood pressure. And that's if you take it that along with nitrates. So prescribed to treat chest pain and heart disease contain nitrates. So in other words, unwittingly, you're getting these products that you didn't know that you were taking. So again, it's Reload, Get It Up, Super Cheetah, Cave Diver, Nights to Remember, and X-Zen Platinum. So this is according to the Food and Drug Administration. Consumers are told that if you have those products, stop using them immediately, throw them away. Last month, they recalled two other sex supplements, Visorex and Black Ant, because those also contained the drugs that are in Viagra and Cialis. So just a health warning in that regard. And now, we've got Felony Magazine, a national casting call, and we're going to speak about what that is and who they are and what it involves, because it's an opportunity for women to make some money and get some fame.
Hello.
Hi, Courtney Hughes. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live and on the air. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you again, Maria.
Thank you, Courtney. Tell us about the Felony Magazine model search and what is Felony Magazine?
Felony Magazine is a magazine that a lot of college kids read, and it's more about the lifestyle of being a model. We found that, you know, it's really popular because we give models, new ones, veterans, to be the chance to have their chance to be reviewed by their modeling peers, photographers, and industry-making decision-makers. So it kind of helps build models' fan bases at the level of where they can help establish their marketability and get forward in their careers.
So is it a magazine that comes in the mail that you buy on the newsstands, or it's online?
It's actually online, and it's also on the stands. It's a periodic field manual, so it's for people that are in the modeling industry. So it's full of feature fashion stories, pictorials, tons of merchandise from their sponsors. And they have, Felony Magazine has its own brand of clothing. So they want to find models that not only can be on the cover of their magazine, but also be in their catalogs and out there selling their products for them and being the models to sell their products.
I would imagine that if you're not a model and you're interested in the female body, it might be something that you want to look at too.
Exactly. That's the thing. That's exactly why the college boys like it. So
yeah.
It's popular in the schools, that's for sure. So it's an industry mag for the models, but it's also a place for the college kids to go and say, oh, that girl's really pretty, I'm going to follow her career, or she seems really interesting. And in that way, as we all know in the world of marketing and branding right now, it's so important to grow your own fan base in whatever medium that is.
So tell us about the model search. What's entailed? Where are the events? How do you get noticed?
It's amazing because this is one of those events that it is. I've worked in lots of castings, as you know, Maria, and I worked with Miss USA and all kinds of TV shows, reality shows, and print ads. But this is one of my most favorite for a lot of reasons, is that you get much more for your audition than just showing up and being a pretty face. They're going to have a week full of auditions, one-on-one interviews, group interviews, panel interviews and photo shoots. So at the end, it's like a panel of judges rating each model in the 5 different categories, and they name this competition's felony girl who gets to receive the cover spot on the September issue of the magazine and lots of other stuff. So the top 25 participants actually get a felony photo shoot during the competition, including a studio shoot, a beach shoot, a shoot on a yacht, and many, many more really exciting locations. So it's not like they're just standing in front of a white board. They're actually going out and they're working it. And in each week, the judges will rate the models based on their looks, personality, and the ability to hold true to the felony brand. And they'll conduct elimination votes throughout the week, so people will be able to participate in which models stay and which don't. So that's kind of where that fan base comes in. The way you get to come to the casting call is by contacting me, and we'll give that information, I'm sure, at the end. But the first event is a meet and greet on July 8th, and it's a party for you to meet all of the other, you know, the sponsors and the people involved in the event so that they can get to know you one-on-one and how you act out in the real world. And the winner who gets to be the cover girl is also going to receive part of $25,000 in cash. They get promotional contracts with the magazine, media appearances, and full model branding packages. They get a lot of, they say they give out their felony apparel to the winner like candy, and gift certificates for other swimwear and other apparel. So it's an amazing casting. It's not just, hey, you know, we just want a girl for the cover. They're wanting to use their cover girl to help brand their magazine.
So it's the one thing I like about this that's different from the norm. It seems like it's not just about TNA and about eye candy.
Yeah.
It's about you get to know them a little bit, it sounds like, with the interviews and the panel interviews and the different photo shoots. Because everybody has a bad day. And so if that happens
not
to
me, Maria. I don't have any bad day.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. Okay. So, to me, it sounds like it's a more seasoned approach to something instead of just a hit and miss. In terms, though, of July 8th, that would mean that you have to be in the area to attend that party, right?
That's true. But this would be one of those things where if you were to ever want to come in from out of town for something, you don't have to have an agent to do this. So it's open to everyone. And that's why we're with you today to get it out there. And my Facebook page and friends and are all jumping on all over it. But Felony Magazine wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity to reach an even greater audience. I've had people come to casting calls from many places across the country. And if it's something that a girl wants to do, then I don't see why she wouldn't fly out here and spend July 8th meeting and greeting with the people who are putting this event on.
So, Courtney, tell me this. In order to go to the July 8th event, do you have to be selected based on their submissions, or anybody can attend? How's that working?
No, they'll have to submit, and they will come through me, and they'll send their email information, and I will send it on to the Felony Magazine so that they know that, that I've kind of pre-approved them, and they've met, they're from me. And then they will go through a submission process, but mostly they're looking for an open casting call. So they're not asking for anyone who's got professional headshots or, any background in it. They're really looking for that fresh, raw talent, girls that haven't been out there in the industry yet.
Okay. So the open casting call, and then because we're on the net, that means that anybody who's listening, in theory, can attend. Why don't you give the way, and then we're going to post it also when we post the podcast later today.
Perfect. Everyone can reach me at my send me an email stating your name, your address, your statistics, in other words, your height, weight, and and a cover picture, and a picture would be nice. It doesn't have to be a fancy photo, but a picture, and send it to my email, which is Courtney, CourtneyHughes, Hughes, like Howard, HughesHughes, 65@gmail.com, or they can call me directly at 310-433-9952. So that's Courtney Hughes 65@gmail and 310-433-9952.
Now, with the picture, do you want a full body shot or you want to
I think it would be best to do a close-up and a full body shot, but if you only have one or the other, everybody has a camera phone right now, so go out and get a nice picture of yourself. You know, possibly a bikini would be good. They are looking for that, you know, wow factor. They're not looking for, you know, kind of prim and proper. This is a sexier magazine. You know, it's not Maxim or Playboy, but it's definitely, you know, the girls on there are definitely, you know, cute and showing it. So we want, I'm sure they're looking for personality plus, because this is not, like I said, just about being a pretty face on the runway or in a catalog. They really want that personality.
Now, I'm assuming you're not looking for somebody like me, so you must have some constraints in terms of age.
They have no constraints as far as age, which I totally appreciate.
Oh.
And as the mature woman that I am as well,
mm-hmm.
They have no limit other than you can't be younger than 17.
Okay.
And quite a few events do take place in, you know, in adult establishments, so I'm not sure that, you know, if you're 17, 16, you've got to consider that some of these events are going to be taking in place with in a mature situation.
But you don't mean illicit. You mean that if you're under 21 years of age, you can't partake of the alcohol that's being served.
Yes, there would be none of that.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, and I know parents would be concerned possibly about that. But for me and for the look that we want, we want a great age. Whoever it is, it doesn't matter what their age is.
So, Courtney, do you have something in mind, or are you open to anything? Like, are you looking for the brown hair, brown-eyed brunette kind of a thing, or are you looking for the blonde bombshell? Or are you?
I'm looking for all the above. As a casting director for so many things, and as I said before, for the Miss California pageant, which I recruited the winner last year, I look for everyone. I see beauty in so many different kinds of women, and I don't mind if someone submits and they are a plus size girl or they've got tattoos. If that's their look and that's how they want to market themselves, I'm fine with that. But if you want to go, you know, I mean, they're looking for that kind of girl next door with that sexy factor.
You know what? Everything you've said so far, I'm thinking, okay, this is cool. It's not some, you know, just skin thing. It's you're talking about quality. You're not just talking about eye candy. You're talking about, obviously, the interviews, they have to be able to string sentences together. So they have.
Well, notice that the first event that they have, their casting call, they're not just sitting there saying, hey, come up and slate and walk the runway. They're saying, we're going to meet and greet. So that would show the kind of personality that they're looking for, someone who can go to events and promote themselves and also Felony Magazine. That's mm-hmm. the number one thing. They want to get their brand out there, and their Felony Magazine cover girl is going to represent that.
Excellent. Anything else you want to add?
No, just it was a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope you invite me back.
Of course, Courtney. Thank you so much for your time. And we will post that information on our website later today when we post the podcast, which is what we do every day, by the way, and that's on mariasanchez.com and themariasanchezshow.com. So guess what? If you can believe this, a professor in New Zealand has studied all 6,000 Lego minifigures and the faces on them. And he says the number of happy faces on Lego toy minifigures is decreasing, and the number of angry faces is increasing. So he says we cannot help but wonder how the move from only positive faces, which is what Legos used to be, to increasing number of negative faces impacts on how children play, and that the themes that have been established, like pirates or Harry Potter, have become increasingly based on conflict. So you should know that if you have children and that you are into Legos, that children growing up with Legos today do not have just the smiley faces that were there probably when you were growing up. So just pay attention to that. There might be subtle messages that are going on in that regard, but that's in the news. He's going to report that paper at a conference later on in the summer. And then in the world news, we have the Edward Snowden, who's the American, the 29-year-old, who leaked details of the U.S. surveillance programs, is still believed to be in Hong Kong. They think he's in a safe house. He's technically free to leave China, that town, at any time, and he has not yet been charged by the government, nor is he subject to of an extradition request. But apparently the United States is looking into it. So one of the attorneys who has done extradition cases in Hong Kong said the attitude of the judiciary here seems to be, if Uncle Sam wants you, Uncle Sam will get you. And then finally, that heinous man in Cleveland who allegedly kidnapped those three young women in his house for a decade pleaded not guilty this morning. So he was indicted last week on 329 criminal accounts. including aggravated murder and the assault and impregnation of Michelle Knight. And he's being held an $8 million bond. A committee is going to consider the death penalty after a complete indictment is issued. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. We're going to leave you with our theme song. Have a great day. Look forward to visiting with you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Talking, so call Maria. Her show is killer. You won't believe it, darling. There's long time listeners.